Okay. Well, thank you so much for having us today to talk. So I'm Mike Barnett, and this is?
And I'm Nicola Tillman.
We work at Microsoft Research in Redmond. So Microsoft Research has campuses in several places around the world, including Beijing, Cambridge, England, Bangalore, India, and a couple of places in California. But what we'd like to talk to you today about is some work that has come out of research and now is making the slow transition to becoming available to outside developers and potentially being incorporated as part of the products that come out of Microsoft.
So we are going to talk about code contracts and PECs. Code contracts is a great way to write powerful assertions, and PECs helps with writing unit tests.
So what we're going to show you today are the ways that you can use code contracts to encapsulate your design intent so that instead of remaining as natural language specifications or semi-accurate comments that may be in the code or may not be in the code, we use code contracts as a way to record in a tool-discoverable manner the intent behind the code. So I'm sure everyone here has had the problem where you sit down with some code that maybe you wrote but you haven't seen for a long time. More likely it's code someone else wrote and you've inherited and had to deal with. And you see the code, but there's decisions behind why it was written the way it was written that are often difficult to reconstruct. And code contracts gives you a way to formally record that so that tools can be used to assist you in your programming tasks. So our team has produced a few prototypes of tools that show the kinds of things that can happen once you use code contracts. And so I'll show you some things about runtime checking that can be done to find errors during code execution sequences. And we also have some advanced research on static checking, which looks at code at compile time and does advanced things beyond what a compiler can check to find out potential errors in your code.
So code contracts are a great way to state all the conditions that should hold in your code, pre and post conditions. That's very important when it comes to testing, and you want to make sure that the code is doing the right thing. But you still need test cases that actually exercise different scenarios of the code, and that's where PECs comes in. PECs makes it easy to generate test cases that achieve high code coverage. And PECs leverages all the contracts that you can write with code contracts in order to detect whether the code is doing the right thing or not. So what PECs enables is a new kind of unit testing that we call parameterized unit testing. So we can have more expressive unit tests taking parameters, and then PECs figures out all the inputs to cover the different corner cases in the code. A very important aspect of unit testing is that you need to isolate your code from the environment. If a test case needs a connection over the network where you have a database, that is not a unit test anymore. It would be a rather fragile test, or it's an integration test then. So in order to do unit testing, you need to isolate your code from the environment, and we have a framework called Molds that makes that very easy. It can deal with interfaces, it can create subclasses for interfaces, and we can also deal with testing in the presence of static methods and sealed classes that are otherwise untestable.
And so each tool in isolation gives you a lot of advantage as you're writing your code, and what we're going to try to illustrate for you today is how if you use them in combination, it becomes an even more powerful tool to help you. And I'd also like very much to encourage people to ask questions or make comments during the presentation. So really don't wait until the end and feel free to just jump in.
So let's get started.
Okay. So everybody seems to want to write a web service these days, and we tend to follow the crowd, so we're going to try to write a web service. And the web service we want to write is a very simple one that takes orders coming across and processes them against an interface for a warehouse that is able to process the orders, get them from the warehouse, and ship them to the customers. And so we're going to write this entire huge system for you in the next few minutes.
So that sounds like a lot of work. What is a warehouse? What is an order?
All right. So maybe we'll start with at least a few things already defined for us. An order is going to be a simple thing. It's going to have the identity of the user who wants the order, the product they want, and how many items they want. And the main point here is that we're programming against this interface. At this point, we don't necessarily even have an implementation of a warehouse. We need to be able to develop our code against the specifications of what a warehouse can accomplish for us. And right now, the only thing we know is that there's two methods in that interface. One way to remove something from the inventory and another method that will actually ship it to the customer.
So what we will implement is a process method that will use this warehouse interface to move around items.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's do it.
All right, I think they've seen enough slides. Why don't we go over here and actually start doing some code?
So given an order, so the order had a quantity in it. So what we should do is, in a loop, go over all the items specified in the quantity. And then for each item, we can remove it from the warehouse, from the inventory. IntelliSend helps. Mm. And yeah, the order had a product ID in it. And then we tell the guys in the warehouse to ship it to the customer. So the username was in the order, and the item had an item ID. Okay.
Okay.
That looks pretty straightforward. You probably have written code like that before. What could possibly be wrong at runtime when we execute this? So does it compile?
I don't know. Let's find out. If it compiles, then we're probably done, and we can let everybody go, because everybody knows that the compiler is going to tell us anything that's wrong. And it turns out that if we look at the output from the compiler, we somehow seem to have a very smart compiler, because it's telling us that there's things that might be wrong with this code that your compiler that you're using today probably isn't warning you about. And that's because what I did before the demo was go to our website that's available through DevLabs, which is a Visual Studio site where they put out advanced technology to gain community feedback to see what things people like and would like to see in new products. And I downloaded our tools from there, and our tools integrate into Visual Studio. So now when I compiled, we get these extra things that, whoops, these extra warnings that the compiler hasn't given to us. Can everybody see that down there? No? Great. Is that better? There we go. So it's giving us notice that some things are possibly going to go wrong in the code at runtime, and we have not done sufficiently careful programming to avoid those problems. I'm sure that at least some of you in the audience had already spotted some of these as we wrote the code. Okay, so let's go back and look at the first warning we have. And it's telling us that something could go wrong at that point, program point, when the loop is executed. And, nope, okay. They don't want to tell us what's wrong. I think they're embarrassed by what bad programmers we are. How could we possibly take a parameter and dereference it without checking first to see if it's null? That's one of the most common programming errors that people make in object-oriented programming.
So we could just do some defensive programming to avoid the issue?
Sure. Let's just check to see if order is null, and in that case, I guess there's nothing to do. We'll just return.
And then are the code contracts tools clever enough to detect that we can then no longer crash?
I'm going to find that out. I'm going to do that by building again. So all of our tools are language independent, so they don't care what .NET language you're writing in. This code happens to be in C#. It could be in VB, F#, any of the other .NET languages. Our analysis is at the IL level, the bytecode level, that the compiler produces. And so after I build, then our tools are invoked, and now the code contracts has looked at the code and realizes that there's one less warning. So it's smart enough to know that now there's no possibility of a null dereference there, which is good. I mean, clearly, as soon as you looked at that code, you knew there's now no longer a possibility of a null dereference, and so it's a nice idea that the tools are you know, agreeing with that.
We are making progress. We are down from 3 to 2 warnings.
Okay.
What's next?
Well, let's look at the highlighted one, the one that talks about item being null. So how could item be null? Item is something that we remove from the warehouse. If we remove something from the warehouse, it must be there. It can't possibly be null.
Then, oh, that should be easy. We just go into the implementation and make sure it doesn't return null.
Okay, so let's go to the definition and see where it's defined. Mm. Oh, wait a minute.
It's an interface, so we cannot check that the result is a null. I mean, how can I write a check in the code if there isn't any code yet?
That's right, and I would like to know that it's never null no matter what the implementation is, right? I don't care who comes along and provides that implementation for the warehouse. I would like to somehow specify that my intention is that I should never get back a null item from the warehouse. And so Code Contracts provides extra facilities now to be able to record those decisions. So what I'd like to say is that the return value from this method should never be null. And the way we do that in Code Contracts, because we want to be language independent, we don't give you a new programming language. We give you a library of methods that you can call from within your .NET program. And if I'm going to give you a library method to call, then you need a method to call it in, right, to put the method call inside of. And interfaces don't have method bodies, so it seems that we're kind of at an impasse here. But if we create a class whose only existence in life, so all of the Code Contracts tools are inside of a new namespace that's available in .NET 4.0 called Contracts. And so what I've done here is I've created a class which is not meant to be the implementation of an interface of the warehouse, but is a container that can hold specifications about the warehouse. So you can see here that the definition of the interfaces are partial. So here's the actual method signatures that are in the interface. Hopefully, if people aren't aware of the partial keyword, that lets me add more information about the interface. And in particular, I'm going to tell our tools that specifications about this interface are contained in the contract class.
So I think what you wanted to do here is wanted to specialize it for the warehouse so that everything is linked up together.
Beautiful. Thank you. And now I just need to implement the warehouse inside of the contract class. And what I'd like to say is that the return value that comes back from remove from inventory is non-null. And that means that it's a statement about the post state of the method, what is true after the method executes. And that's called a post condition. And a post condition is expressed with the library method ensures, which belongs to the static class contract. And now I need a way to talk about the return value that comes back from this method. And so we're going to have another encoding for that, which is that the result value, which is of type item, should not be equal to null. So now this is a statement that says that any implementation of this interface, if you're using the Code Contract tools, is going to be held against this guarantee that we would like to make, that the item that's returned is never a null item.
That sounds interesting. But okay. So are we done yet, or it still says not implemented?
Right. So there's no, this class is abstract. There will never be any instances created of this class. Our tools will just notice from these custom attributes that are put on the interface and on the class that it should just take the contracts from these methods and apply them to any implementation.
So this class is really just for the Code Contract tools. It's not meant to be ever executed.
That's right. So it's fine to just have as the body just say throw an exception. There's no problem with that.
So the tools will pick up this call, they will see it, and then they apply it to all implementations.
That's right. So let's look in particular. Here's a call to that method. And now if I build the solution again, yes, question.
I'm just curious, if someone builds a warehouse implementation without PEX, so they wouldn't get the warning if they're not adhering to the contract, at runtime, when consuming that interface, will PEX sort of kick in and say, or blow up ahead of time saying this is not a valid implementation?
Okay, so the question was if an implementation is developed without using code contracts, then it's not going to be, then there's no way to enforce this against that implementation. And if that implementation was plugged in here, then we could still have a null dereference. Yes, that's true. Yeah. But I'll show you, in a few minutes, I'll show you a way that you can protect against that as well.
Yeah. But so the basic idea is you need to install our tools and apply them. Otherwise, the contracts won't get checked in the code that you build yourself.
Yeah, but that's correct. But at least now we know that if the tools are being used, then we're guaranteed that we don't have to do any defensive programming here. That at runtime, there's no need to do the extra computation to worry about that case. So that's, you know, and the hope, of course, is that everyone will start using these tools and then you won't have that problem. But that's a good question. Okay.
So now we have an interface contract and we should get less warnings, right?
Yep. So I think I built and let's look. And sure enough, now we're down to just one warning. So we're making progress.
We are getting there, but we are not done yet. So yep. What is that?
Okay. So
Null reference.
There's another null reference. And I'm looking at this method and I just don't understand where that comes from. So the tool that I've been running at each build is a static checker that is considering any possible execution sequence. And so it's often the case that the problems that it finds have to do with a scenario that's very difficult for you to figure out, you know, just by looking at the code. Right? So maybe I'm sure there's some people in the audience that are already clearly understanding where this null dereference could come from, but in a more advanced scenario, I guarantee if you use our tools, there will become a point where you say, I'm sure this thing is right. Why is this stupid tool complaining to me?
Yeah.
And so what you really need at that point is, you know, some concrete way of saying, I need a real execution sequence that shows me where that error comes from.
I have just the right tool for you, Mike. So to repeat what Mike just said, what you get here in the error list, there are warnings about things that might go wrong. But without having a test case, it's difficult to really understand what the issue might be. So the other tool we are going to talk about is PEX. And it's a Visual Studio Power tool, so again, you have to download it separately. And I already did that on this machine. So I can now go to any method, any public method in my code, right-click on it, and I have a new menu item that is called Run PEX. And so what that will do when I invoke it, it will run the code with different inputs, monitor what the code is doing, and using a constraint solver, come up with different inputs to exercise all the different behaviors. And what I will get back are test cases. So let's do that. I invoke PEX. It is now starting up the process and actually going to run the code. The first thing that we will get back is a table. Let me expand it a bit. So what you see in this table is, first of all, that for every parameter of the method we are testing, there's going to be a column. Yeah. So there's the explicit order parameter, and then there's the implicit this parameter called target here. And then for every input, for every parameter, PEX generates inputs, values, and we get one row per generated input. So there's one test case that PEX generates where we pass null, that's kind of obvious, and we have the defensive programming for order, so nothing bad happens when we pass null. Then there's another test case where a proper order is constructed and the quantity is zero. Everything is nice in that case too. And then finally, there's a case where the quantity is one. In that case, PEX shows us not only the input, but also the output, which in this case is an exception, null reference exception. And when I double click on it, it indeed takes us to the line where we before got a warning. So with PEX, you get additional details of the values that actually can trigger an exception. And I was talking about testing and test case generation, but all I showed you so far was a table. So what I can also do with PEX, and that's even better, is I can actually save the generated test cases. So there's a button to save the tests and get a dialog that is telling me that PEX is about to generate an entire test project. So just follow through with the dialog. So PEX will now generate a lot of code, link up a new test project with the code under test. Takes a moment. Okay. So what we have now is the following view in our solution. So we have the original project with our code under test, and then a new project was generated by PEX, and it is linked up with our product code, and then it has lots of stuff in it. In particular, there's a file with generated test cases, and that's what we see here on the screen. So each generated test case, it's a unit test tagged with the Visual Studio unit test attributes. We also support other unit testing frameworks. And then in the test, first, there's code to create data that will trigger a particular code path, and then we call the code under test. So having a test case, we can now debug the issue. So when I go back to my product code and the place where we ran into the exception, I can set a breakpoint here and then debug using our generated test case. There's a friendly debug button in our user interface. Okay. Now the debugger starts up. That takes a moment. Generating test cases wasn't much slower. Okay. Now we are in the debugger. We have a live debugging session, and we can look at all the values, and we can see that, in fact, the store is null. So there's a little tooltip here. When I press F10, we will indeed crash, and we get the exception that we have a null reference exception. So now it should be easy to see what's happening, right?
Okay.
Did you see?
Well, I agree. I see that it's null, but can I go back to the scenario and see what actually brought that null to be in that spot?
Let's stop the debugger. So we have the construction of the input data. So we can follow through here now, see that. So we pass a null value into the constructor of web service, and we store it. So it's null.
I should have been able
kind
to see
that. Kind of obvious.
Yeah, I think probably some people actually saw that.
And this is a test case. I mean, once you have the test case,
really
becomes
with the
obvious.
Test case, then you immediately see it. So now even I can find the error, and I know that the problem is that I allowed, just as I didn't do any defensive programming initially in the process method, I'm not protecting myself here from someone passing in a null to the constructor, and I would like to prevent that.
Yeah, so we could do some argument validation, right?
Yep.
If store is null, so null reference exception or argument null exception.
Right, and I think we have something even better. So as you saw when we specified something about the interface method, we were talking about the return value, something about the post state. I would like to enrich my signature of the constructor. I would like to tell clients that not only do they have to pass me a value that is type compatible with iWarehouse, but really what I want is an argument that isn't null. And that's expressed using the contract.requires method. And again, I have to put in a using statement. And the class contract lives within that namespace inside of MS Corelib in .NET 4.0. So now you can think of this as an enriched signature where it's part of the type of the method. So we're making a type system that's even smarter than what the normal compiler sees. The normal compiler, all it cares about is that a value is passed that's type compatible, and null is such a value, and now we're saying no, it has to be a non-null value that's compatible with iWarehouse.
Okay, so at runtime it will do the same thing as my usual argument validation check?
Well, what happens when you install our tools is in the property page, we add a pane and we give you full control over what happens. So we've separated the ability to say, here is my contract, here is what must be true, from what is the behavior of a failing contract. So in this case, I've turned on runtime checking, and I've decided that in any case, and then I have the ability to either say that I would like to have an assertion fired on contract failure, or if it's cleared, then the default is to have an exception thrown. And we also give you the ability to custom program your own behavior. So you might want to only log the fact that an error happened and continue execution. And so we give you lots of different possibilities to enforce what happens when a contract fails.
Okay, so we have another contract now. So that should make sure it's not null. And it should convince the compiler to no longer show us a warning.
Well, let's try building and see what the static checker thinks of the code now.
It's nope. Still there.
It's still complaining about the null dereference. But so that seems strange.
Yeah, we wrote in the constructor that it cannot be null, so.
So maybe the tools just aren't aware that it really, really is null. So maybe I'll put a post condition here.
Oh, like you did in the interface.
That's right. And I'll say that it's that really, store is not null. I mean, this is clear. Our tools are actually smart enough to figure that out from the precondition and the fact that we're assigning to the field. But maybe I just need to, you know, shout at the tool and really, you know, make it clear. So I'll tell it that there's a post condition as well.
So I don't quite understand this, Mike. So you wrote a post condition, as you say, but this condition, when you check it here, it's not true yet. We need to put it after we did all the updates.
Right. So that is because, as I said, we're trying to express the fact that these are the declarative conditions that must be true about our methods. Think of it again as part of the method signature. And all of that should be, you know, I mean, as close as possible to the, you know, it's just like this method. This method process returns type void, and that's told to you up in the signature, right? So we want the same idea that contracts are something that belong to the view of the method and not to the implementation. This is a very simple constructor, but it might be that I have some huge piece of code with many different exit points. And if I had to put my specification of what happens at the return of the method at each one of those exit points, then I would have to worry about making sure that every time I said something, it was consistent with all the other return points. So our tools are going to look at this and understand that, no, this is a contract about the return point of the method, even though syntactically I wrote it at the beginning of the method.
Well, I hear your intention, but I cannot quite believe it because I see the code as it's written. So I want to actually run a test case to understand what's happening, okay?
Well, we already have a test case. Why don't we run the one that we have and just go in the debugger and show them?
Yeah, I pretty much want to do that. So I want to see what happens when I go in here. Now, so I need to generate test cases again because we put in more contracts, and the old test cases, they passed null, right?
Right.
So let me run PEX again to generate test cases. PEX picks up all the contracts, and it should respect them. And then, let's see. No.
Yeah.
That is not what I wanted. Let me run a
second row.
Let me run again.
All right.
No, it doesn't do what I want. I have to add some annotation. I'm not sure exactly why it's not doing what I want right now, but it should. I will talk later about what I've just been doing. Let's try that again.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't do what I want. Maybe it did all the time what I want. Oh, it did it. Okay. New feature. So let's just debug this test case. And you see it's now, okay. We now should have a non-null store. Yes, we do. Where does that come from? I will talk about that later. But so let's step through this code and see how the requires and ensures get executed.
Okay.
So let me press F10 to go to the next line. That's strange. We jumped backwards.
Right. So remember, the precondition is something that has to be true before you're even allowed to enter the method. So the first thing that happens is the preconditions are checked. We successfully passed the precondition. A non-null store was passed to this constructor. So now we're able to enter the method. Press F10 again, and you'll see. We'll start executing the method. No? Something went wrong again. What?
It didn't continue here. Let's try that again. Debug.
Okay.
We step. To the beginning.
Here we go.
Enter. Okay.
So now we're entering the method, and I'll press F10 to step one more time. And now we execute the body of the method. And now it's time to leave the method.
So the ensures didn't get checked. We skipped over the ensures.
We skip over the ensures until we're done. It's time to return to the caller. And now we evaluate the post condition.
Wow. So we jump forward and backward to check requires and ensures before and after.
That's right. So even though you specify everything at the beginning of the method, our tools rearrange the binary and rearrange the debugging information so that you know, I think this is the kind of experience that you would want to see, you know, having written this kind of code.
I see. That was very interesting.
Okay.
Can you remind me of all the different things we have just seen about code contracts?
Sure. Let's go back to the slides then. All right. So we talked about the fact that when you have code, you're going to want to be able to tell clients things that must be true before they can call your code. So these are things that it's their responsibility. It's a programming error if they violate these. People tend to do that today with parameter validation code. Parameter validation code there's nothing wrong with it. That's how it works today. The difference is that by using contracts, you're now able to elevate those checks that are inside your code and make them visible to clients through the use of our tools. What happens today is you go to documentation, you read it, it says, well, if you do these bad things, these are the exceptions you're going to get. Then you have to wonder about whether or not that documentation is actually correct with respect to the code. Is that really how it behaves? And with code contracts, now you're guaranteed that those conditions are going to be in sync with what the code actually does. Similarly, you can specify what must be true at method exit. So in this case, it's an internal thing that has to do with a private field, you know, a field in the class that's not visible to the client. But for public APIs, this would be something that tells the client what they can assume once the method's returned to them. What conditions? Yes? Ah, great question. I'm so happy you asked that. Yes, we get this question all the time.
So what was the question again?
So the question was, this seems like very special kind of code. Why should it just be written as code sitting in your method body? Why not use custom attributes or maybe some kind of special comment convention to indicate the contracts? So there are many, many benefits, which I think you saw as I was writing them, but you know, you're so used to seeing, you know, code being written inside of a nice IDE that you weren't even aware of it, right? So one thing that you get from writing it in code is these method calls are available in any .NET language. The expressions I write inside those calls is the language that the programmer is using. So we were writing C# code, so those expressions were C# expressions. If I'd been writing VB code, it would have been VB expressions.
And so, we are going to show you later more examples of more complicated contracts that you couldn't write in a custom attribute.
Right. So custom attributes give you a limited, very limited form of the kinds of things you can write. And here, you're not constrained at all. You can write any kind of expression in the programming language that you're using. Yeah?
Is there any way to generate some documentation or some from this code contract?
Excellent, yeah. So the question was, is it possible to generate documentation? So I didn't show that to you as part of the demo, but on the slide, if people can see it, there's the third point is, yes, so we automatically take all the conditions that are in the contracts. So there's a couple of ways we do that. One way is we have a experimental extension to Visual Studio 2010. So one important feature of contracts is that they're inherited by subtypes. So for instance, we know that there's a contract on the two-string method of object that says that the return value should not be null. And so if you write an override of two-string, our tools come along and will show that to you as you're programming to remind you about that, so that as you write your implementation, you can live up to the contracts that you're inheriting. The other thing we do is we take all of the contracts, and if you have turned on the XML documentation generation for your project, so that an XML file is generated containing the XML doc comments, we will enrich that XML with new tags and holding the contents of the contracts. And then we have modified style sheets for Sandcastle, for instance, so that then the XML we enrich the documentation file with end up showing up in your generated help file or web page. So, and I think that's a really important, often underappreciated feature of using code contracts. It's so important to make sure that these things become part of the living documentation that people see. So. Yep.
Yeah.
That's Joseph's just appeared there. Looks like something that is in my source code, but obviously it isn't.
That's right. So good question. So the comment was that we're seeing something that sort of looks like source code, but it, of course, isn't. That's right. So it's called a visual adornment. It's a new type of visual element that the new extension model in Visual Studio 2010 allow you to create.
So I cannot step into it. It's just...
Right. So if we move the cursor, you'll see it's not really there in the text file. If you save the text file, it's not there. It's just a visual that comes up while you're editing to remind you. And that's one of the things we're looking for, is the kind of feedback, like, is that confusing to see it that way? Okay. This is a huge internal debate we're having in the team, and I'm on your side, and this is great. Now I can go back and say, it's not just me. Everybody, this is what real people say. So that's. I think it should be something that's clearly not to be confused with a line of text in your code.
Okay.
Okay. So what we're trying to point out is, by adopting a standardized format for writing these specifications, you can use them for all these different uses. So you've seen runtime checking, you've seen the static checking, I've talked about the documentation generation, you've seen a little bit of the IDE integration we can get for providing help for programmers. One thing we didn't show you in the demo was that so far all you've seen are method contracts. So that's part of the API. It's telling clients what they have to do to call a method and what they get in return. But as you all know, a huge part of programming is you have a class with many complicated internal data structures, and keeping the relationships between those internal data structures consistent is probably the hardest task in programming. And that's exactly the thing where when you inherit some code, you have no clue. Like, why do they update this thing this way and update this other thing the other way? And that's called an object invariant. So expressing what it means for an object to be in a consistent state is done using the method contract.invariant. And we give you a way to embed those in any arbitrary method you want. You decorate the method with a custom attribute that tells our tools that this is something that should be understood to be this internal consistency. And we check it at the end of constructors and at the end of public methods.
Let's do that in our code.
Okay.
So you say that if I want something to be true at the end of every public method, instead of writing an ensures statement in all the methods, I can just write an invariant?
That's right. So let's remove that sort of the redundant post condition and put in a invariant that says this dot store is not equal to null. So now this is something that is going to be enforced against every constructor and against every public method. It means that I really want to record the fact that I never intend this field to be null. So people try to express that now, say, with read-only specifiers and trying to control the visibility, but that doesn't actually control the behavior of the field. And this gives you a way to specify it in a truly enforceable manner.
And so I write this once, and it will be checked all over the place at all public methods?
That's right. So
that's amazing.
So, for instance, let's try to violate it. Let's do something quite obvious and set it to be null here and run the static checker again. And sure enough, the tools have noticed that, is that visible? Right? That at the exit of that method, even though that method itself is not specifying anything about that field, the tools know that the intention is that you should not be leaving that method with the store field being null.
So that points to the end of the method where we violated.
That's
I see.
Right, exactly.
That's nice.
Okay.
Let's remove that.
Yeah. Seems like, yes, questions?
Is there any way of specifying this kind of generic defensive approach for all parameters, like you know, making sure nothing is ever called?
So the question was?
So yeah, the question is there any way to say no parameter should ever be null?
Yeah.
Great, yeah, that's a good question. So the Code Contracts project is a spin-off from a previous research project we had in our group called SpecSharp. That was also, I don't know, maybe people have heard of it. And in SpecSharp, we created what was called a non-null type system, where you could just blanketly declare that all reference types should never be null, unless you mark them specially and say, this particular one could be null.
Just like nullable types, you had non-nullable types, right? And
that's
then
right.
They can never be null.
Exactly. And the problem with implementing that in this framework is that we are doing this as a library-based approach. And in order to have a true non-null type system, you have to have language changes and you have to have support in the runtime, in the virtual machine. We would love to get there. I mean, it's true that the most common specification is that things aren't null. And that's something we would love to get to. And this gets us partway there by at least, you know, if it turns out that everybody sees that 90% of the specifications are all about nullness, that might finally convince the evolution of the .NET framework to say that that's an important feature to bake into the runtime.
So I mean, it's very intuitive to say, yeah, I want things to be non-null. But if you follow that through, what it means for initialization and everything else, that's a huge change you're making. And it was too big to be feasible.
Okay, so the question is it possible to have an invariant over each iteration of the loop? We wouldn't call that a contract invariant. If you want something true at a particular program point, then we have another method. You can certainly make assertions, right? And so you can assert something should be true at that program point. We don't currently have a way to express loop invariance, if that's what you're asking about, other than using an assertion. Yeah. The question is, are the object invariants enforced at runtime as well as just by the static checker? And the answer is yes. So I'm going to talk in just a second about exactly how that runtime checking happens, and then you'll see that all of the contracts are actually injected into the runtime code.
So I'm just using PEX to generate test cases that actually will expose the runtime behavior of contracts. And what you see here is that when I put back in this bogus null assignment. Now we indeed get an exception here at runtime, and what fails is the invariant that we wrote, and in the stack trace we can see that it was invoked at the end of the process method. Yeah.
So, maybe make that bigger.
So we get a stack trace that says that our test case invokes the method under test, and it in turn calls the invariant method, which then fails with an exception. So it does get checked at runtime. And yeah, so we have in this case a test case that can reproduce it.
Okay. Great. You also saw in the demo that we're able to even express, question. Perfect question. The question was, did the contract show up in debug and release builds? You're getting two more slides, and I'll show you that. Exactly. This is great. I think you probably arranged all these people in the audience to be here. Right, so we even are able to put contracts on places where you wouldn't normally think. Once we tell you we're going to write contracts as code, it seems that it would be difficult to put them on interfaces and abstract classes. So I showed you that we actually have a way to work around that. Right? And then you saw briefly that we have an integration into the Visual Studio project system so that you can control the behavior of the contracts. When you asked about how to control whether they appear in both debug and release or not, we have a way to a knob there that you can turn, and you can decide exactly what you want injected into your runtime code. So some teams make the decision that preconditions are very important. They want the parameter validation in every method. And so they would like the preconditions injected into the runtime code. But of course, the postconditions, once you're finished developing your code, there's no more bugs left in it. There's no need to be checking the postconditions. So you're not going to release runtime code that has it in it. Great. So that gets into exactly how the runtime checking works. So what we saw was that once you've turned on runtime checking, all the code is just code. The compiler just sees it, and it produces the binary portion that evaluates the preconditions. It generates the binary code that evaluates the body, and it generates the binary code that evaluates the postconditions. And then as a post-build step, we rewrite the code. So we take that binary and we munge it around, so you see that there's the... here's just the code that evaluates the preconditions, and now the code that evaluates the body. And that's because up here, we chose just to have only preconditions injected. If you don't want to have any code, if say you know that your clients are trusted, maybe this is internal code that while you're developing it, you want to make sure is well guarded against clients, but once it's released, it's always inside of a protected environment, then you can just turn off the runtime checking and have just the code that's in your the body of the methods.
How is that different from unchecking the checkbox that says perform runtime checking?
Yeah, good question. So the question was, how is that different than unchecking the checkbox? Yeah, I don't know. I'll go back.
We never
That's
wanted
good.
To uncheck.
I've never box. Unchecked it, so I yeah, and I never choose none. I always, I want all my contracts. I want everything. I don't know. That's a good question. Okay.
One thing it might do is it might remove some contracts from the assembly which otherwise would leave in there, like the invariant methods.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so there is extra stuff that gets generated by the... that's true. So if you put on none, then it's actually going to strip out the invariant methods and other things that you were there only, or those contract classes you saw that were used to hold the contracts mm-hmm. for the interfaces.
Yeah. And so it's whether the rewriter runs or not.
It's the checkbox is whether the rewriter runs or not. None means don't enforce contracts and make sure to get rid of all the extra goo that is laying around that you don't want in there. Yeah, that's true.
No,
yeah,
no.
Good
that's
question. True. Yeah.
Have you tried it on Cube's code bases and seen what's the penalty of execution?
Great. So the question is, have we tried it on huge code bases? And what is the runtime penalty of evaluating the contracts? So there are some product groups inside Microsoft that are experimenting with it. I wouldn't say that they've used it on any huge code bases. There's some external users that have used it on their production code, but I don't have any numbers about how big their code is. In terms of the penalty for overhead, as you see from this slide, the penalty can be as small as zero, right? I mean, you don't have to pay anything. If you want the runtime checking for preconditions, many development teams take a very aggressive approach to parameter validation. So it's not, they're already have that code in there. That's already being executed. So having it expressed as a contract is no different. I mean, the code we generate that the rewriter puts in there is exactly the same code you'd write by hand. Right? It just says if this condition's false, do whatever the error behavior is supposed to be. post conditions can be expensive, right? I mean, if you write a method that says, you know, and the post condition says, you know, the entire web should be a fully connected graph, and it goes out to check that, yeah, it's going to be an expensive check. I mean, right, but you have control over that. So it's there's no penalty beyond what you're putting in there and what you're deciding should be in your code. I would say that the code we generate for the contract checking is as efficient as any of the other code you write. I mean, yeah.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. Okay, the question is whether there's a compile time penalty. So there's a post-build step that does the binary rewriting, and yes, our binary rewriter is not as fast as, for instance, the C-sharp compiler is. So if you have an enormous code base, it will add some time to your compile time. Yeah, that is, and we're working to try to make it more efficient. Again, you know, right now this is a research prototype that we're trying to get feedback from the community about how useful it is and whether it aids them in the development process. You know, if it ever became a real product, that's what the product groups are great at, is making things. I mean, I find the production compilers to be incredibly fast, so I would think they could do the same things with the rewriter. Yeah, good
okay.
question.
So now we have looked intensively into how we can check internal invariants of the code and making sure we don't crash with null errors, but we haven't actually made sure that the program does the right thing, right? The functional correctness.
I don't think anybody cares about it. You think they care about functional correctness?
We should.
I hope they do. All right.
We should. So let's move beyond our null checks and try to look at the functionality. And that is normally where you are starting to write some test cases, unit tests, to exercise scenarios. And I want to do that now with PEX, but a bit more general than normally. So what I want to introduce now are parameterized unit tests, which is basically the idea of adding parameters to a unit test. So you already are writing assertions, and you can use code contracts to write assertions to say this should be true. When you write an assertion in a unit test, you usually do it for one value. Yeah, there's one input, and you write the assertion for one value. What you are doing when you parameterize a test case is you're effectively saying, my assertion is much more powerful. It should be true for all values. So it's kind of making assertions more powerful. So what happened already in the background is that PEX was, in fact, exploring a parameterized unit test that it created. So parameterized unit tests in PEX are tagged with a special attribute that allows them to take parameters. And the one that PEX generated in the background didn't do much yet. There's just a comment inside that we should beef it up and actually write a bit of a scenario and add assertions. And then what PEX was doing is it was not just running the code with different inputs, but it was actually analyzing all the instructions that get executed, looking at all the conditions that are being checked, creating constraints, and using a powerful constraint solver to figure out what values can actually trigger different corner cases. And in the end, so you get a test suite that basically triggers all the corner cases, not more, not less. So let's look in some more detail how PEX generates data. So it always starts from a parameterized unit test, and it generates values. It always starts with the most simple possible values, and then as PEX discovers branches, conditions, constraints, the constraint solver comes up with more complicated values. So initially, we can use null. But if you look carefully, it doesn't make sense to use null everywhere. So here, our web service is a type under test, and we are going to call an instance method on it. So it cannot be null, and this is a type where we want to achieve high code coverage. So we have an attribute to tell PEX what is our type under test. Then whenever there's a method call in the unit test, PEX follows the flow of the program. It looks into the method call. So that's why it's important at certain places to isolate our code from the environment, because otherwise PEX would follow the entire chain of events, and well, if there's a network call, then that's a bit problematic. So In this case, the code is nicely isolated. We can follow the call. Then there's a condition. PEX picks up the condition, and it will first have the test case where order is null. You might have seen that. And then PEX produces a test case where the order is not null. Then there's a loop. PEX detects the loop pattern, and it tries different iterations. And you have seen that we got one test case where the store was null. We debugged that in the beginning. So we get a test case like this. Okay, so far so good. Now we want to write a test case that actually checks the functionality, that when we have an order with a particular quantity, one test case that I want to write is, I want to make sure that the number of items that we actually ship to the customer, so the number of method calls that we invoke ship to customer with, should match the quantity in the order. So to do that, I have a little problem here, which is I actually need to get beyond our null check in store, and I need an actual implementation of the interface to actually execute this loop, yeah, so that it doesn't crash with the null reference exception.
We already did that in the demo.
I did that. Yeah. So what happened there? PEX has a framework to generate stubs for interfaces. And later I will talk about how PEX can also deal stubbing out static methods and dealing with sealed classes. So what PEX does is for every interface, it generates a stub class. And for every method of the interface, the stub class will have a property that has a delegate type. So the delegate has a particular signature that we also include in the name of the property. So in this case, we can set it to a delegate that takes a string and an integer and doesn't return anything. And then the implementation of this generated stub is that it will call the delegate that we can attach. Yeah? So if you have an interface with 100 methods in it, this allows you to write a very small test case where you only need to attach those one or two delegates which actually will get invoked when the product code under test runs. Yeah. So let's do that. Putting it all together, this is a parameterized test that checks that we ship the right number of items. So what does it say? It says that regardless of what the order is, the following should work. So we set up a warehouse using our stub class, and we are attaching a delegate to the ship method. And so I hope you're all familiar with the syntax. So that's a lambda expression. It's basically a method inline. And all I'm doing here is, so I'm not actually shipping anything for test purposes, but I just want to count how often the method is invoked. Yeah? Then we launch our code under test, which will in turn call back into our delegate. So we should increase the count appropriately, and then we assert that indeed the number of times the method was called matches the requested quantity. Sounds straightforward. So let me take this code, go back to my test project. And so there's another file here, which I didn't show before. So there was one file with the generated unit tests, as we all know them. And there's another file here above, which actually contains parameterized unit tests. So we should never edit the generated tests, but we should only write parameterized tests. So here is code that PEX generated already for us. That's what you saw on the slide. And I just paste in now the other test I was proposing. Now I have to get it to compile, so we need to add a using clause for code contracts, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And now it should compile, and I can just right-click on it and launch PEX as before. And just as before, PEX will now analyze my code under test in combination with this test code and the delegate in it and generate test cases. So let's see what we get. See a bunch of failures. Some of them are more obvious than others. So I see that we get invariant failures. And when I double click, I remember that we still have this bogus store in here. Okay, so we found that. That's good. Let's get rid of that. And let's run again. So this is a typical cycle you do when you deal with parameterized unit tests. You make a change. You fix the errors you get. You run again. Okay. So now we get to a new list. There's a question.
I noticed that you used contract.assert in your X method. Does that get converted to an MS test assertion in the generated test?
Excellent question. So the question is, why did we use contract.assert? We could have used the assert class that comes with MS test. And so MS test has this method. And in fact, there are other asserts. You might know debug assert, or in fact, PEX comes with its own set of assert methods. So there are all these different assert methods, and you can use any. The insight is that what is an assert anyway? So if you look at the implementation of any such assert method, yeah, it probably looks like this. If not condition, then fail. Right? So every assertion creates a branch in the code, and then PEX will try to cover it as a special corner case. Yeah? PEX tries to achieve high code and branch coverage, and as a side effect, it tries to violate assertions, any kind of assertion. Another question? Yes. So the question is, what other unit test frameworks we support? So out of the box, we also support NUnit, XUnit, and there are extensions for MBUnit. And if you have your own test framework, you just need to implement an interface. Because essentially, the big difference regarding test frameworks is when we generate unit tests, the question is, what attribute should we put on top? So that's what you have to specify in the interface. It's not much more. Okay. So back to our test case and our issues that we still have. So there's one here that again deals with nullness. So we can have a null reference exception here. What went wrong here? What can we do?
Well, it seems like there's only one dereference in that line, so it must be the fact that order could be null.
Yeah. So there are different ways how to deal with that. We don't want order to be null. We could add some defensive programming here and say that when it's null, we don't check it. We could add a precondition for the test case saying that the order shouldn't null. Or in the paradigm of unit testing, you can also use so-called assumptions that say what shouldn't happen. So a big difference between assume and assert compared to requires and ensures is that requires and ensures always say something about the very beginning of a method and the very end, whereas assumptions and assertions you can put anywhere.
And another big difference is that preconditions and postconditions are meant for your APIs for public clients, and this is test code. There's not really a client of this test code other than the test harness.
Okay, so let's run PEX again and see if we got rid of the null issue. Okay, so no more null reference exception, but what we still get here is a contract exception, an assertion failure, when we pass this input where quantity is min value. What happened here? We thought the code works perfectly fine. We wrote pre and post conditions before.
That's right.
What happened here?
So this is not a behavior. It must not be a behavior of any single method call. It must have something to do with the scenario of repeated method calls.
Yeah. So so what happened here is that our loop in the implementation, it starts at zero. So it doesn't deal with negative values. And then we have the calls to our warehouse, and there's an interaction, and that's why the test failed. Okay, so quantities that are negative don't really make sense. But I think I know now how I can deal with values that don't make sense. I could just add another assumption to my test case and say, just don't bother. What's that?
So now, again, you have to make a design decision, right? So the idea is to record things in contracts that you want to be visible to all callers. And in this case, the first one was an assumption about this particular test case. But talking about negative quantities, to me that seems like not a property of a test case. It's really orders that have negative quantities just don't make sense in the first place. So really what we should do is maybe go to, is remove that and go to the definition of order. And the constructor of order clearly is missing a contract that makes sense, right? So there's what am I trying to say? You need to decide where the boundaries are and where things make sense to enforce specifications.
But often, I mean, the earlier contracts are checked, the better, right?
That's so right.
This is the best place.
This seems like the best place for this kind of.
So I wanted to say that quantity is not negative. And now PEX should respect that. PEX picks up all contracts. And we shouldn't get the negative order test case anymore. I have to run PEX from the parameterized test. No, that didn't work. What happened here?
That hasn't happened before.
No, that hasn't happened before. Let me try the following. So I just installed a new version of PEX, and PEX is getting more clever all the time, but...
There we go.
So PEX tried to use a subtype, but not a good idea. Okay, so
great.
We have no longer the negative value issue, and our type is sealed and safe. But I still think that the test cases look a bit funny. So the username is null. That doesn't really look convincing to me.
Yeah, I think it would be better if we could, you know, generate tests against real usernames.
Yeah, so we know how to deal with that. We have done that before. We add preconditions saying that username is a null.
Yeah,
right?
That's good.
So what will happen now? What are the test cases that get generated with that constraint?
Remember, PEX is always going to try to generate the simplest possible values that pass each test. So the simplest possible value that's not null is going to be
The empty string.
Yeah, maybe not a very convincing username.
So let's write more complicated contracts. And you see that what we are doing now, it would be difficult to do in an attribute. Yeah, in attributes you can only have simple values but no complicated conditions. So we want that the length is at least, say, 4.
Four is good.
That works for you, Mike. Okay, so now we should get a nice username. Let's run again and get some test cases.
All right.
How do they look like now? Well, what is a simple string that is 4 characters long? So PEX tries to come up with the smallest length and with a bit pattern that has the least number of bits set. So that doesn't look realistic. So there are many ways we could make a better contract now.
If you could maybe make the line go through the zeros, it would look good to them, because then it would look more Danish, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So we want really characters, right?
I think real characters would be good.
So one way to deal with the issue is we could write a contract using link, saying that for all characters in the string, we want to have letters. Well, that's up. So the question was whether these contracts are too strong. Is it really a good idea to enforce 4 characters minimum? Isn't that something we should only do in our test case? Right. Well, it depends. So you don't want empty usernames, right? So you have some minimum you want to enforce. Now, what minimum do you want to enforce always for everyone? And maybe 4 is a good number. I don't know. But
we're certainly not saying that this is the... What we're trying to show here is that you can write as anything you want in these contracts. And, yeah, it's certainly the case that what you would actually enforce on what the username could be is going to come from, say, your requirements document or, you know, from scenarios that you generate from users or, you know, whatever you've decided. But we're just trying to show that whatever it is that you've decided, you can encode it here without a problem. And just for this, we're saying, okay, 4 seems like a fun number. But, yeah, absolutely, that's a good comment.
So let's stick with 4 and see what happens when we have the letter constraint. So now we get A's. Yeah, that's the simplest letter there is. And so just to show you what else you could do, we could use, instead of link here, another question?
When this expression gets rewritten into a runtime precondition and you violate it, what type of error would you get? Would you just get username not valid, or would you get something more specific? Would it detect?
Good question.
So
we could write a test case for our order class, and then we should see what happens when we violate contracts. So let's say we have a test case where we create an order, and so we need to pass in these parameters to the constructor, and then we can create an order. And return it. So really, I should add some assertions here that everything got nicely initialized using any assertion framework I like. But for the moment, I just want to let PEX explore and see what kind of exceptions can get thrown. Did we repeat the question? Okay, so the question...
No, you didn't, yeah.
So the question was, what kind of exception gets thrown when a contract fails? And what you see here is that... So we get contract failures for certain inputs that we didn't filter out in the test case. And so it's always a contract exception, but the text in the exception... That is kind of remarkable.
So one thing that the rewriter does, so currently when people write parameter validation code, they tend to write the condition that they want to be true, and then they have to go to great lengths to write some sort of string that's maybe localized and tells you more information about the error. But remember, I was saying that these are preconditions are really developer errors. Developers that use our tools are able to use the tools to avoid the errors. I don't know many people that write applications where they really expect the null dereference errors to go up to the user and the user to know what to do about the string that somehow is generated as part of that parameter validation. So what we do is our tools grab the actual condition text from the precondition and populate the error message with that string. So what you'll get is that there's a failure and you'll get the entire source string of what the condition was. So if you want something more fine-grained, then you could write multiple requires, each one with a smaller condition, perhaps.
How do you do that in a language-agnostic
way? Great question. So the question is, how do we do that in a language-agnostic way? We don't. Okay, so again...
Not today yet.
This is, again, a prototype. And so we don't have we just haven't had the resources to implement a renderer from the binary back to any particular source language. So what we do now is we just capture the source string as it was written. And for, you know, even if that's not the source language you're used to, usually for parameter validation kind of errors, that seems to work out just fine. But yeah, the ideal solution is then it needs to be rendered in the particular language that you've picked for how you want to see the error messages.
Next version.
That's definitely something we're working on.
So something else you could put into a contract is, for example, here, a regular expression. So we could say that our string should match a regular expression saying that everyone should be happy with just 26 characters, uppercase followed by lowercase. But you could put in whatever you want. And that works too.
Question. Ah, great. Even better question.
What's the question?
So the question is, can you abstract this out and put it in some method? So it might be the case that you have some common parameter validation that is consistent across many methods in your class, and you'd like to not have to repeat that precondition, and you would just like to encapsulate all in a method. If you download the tools right now as we're talking, that won't be true, but we're coming out with a new release either today or Monday, and it includes support for that. So we have the idea of an abbreviator. So you make any method you want that encapsulates those checks, that has the contracts in it. You mark that method with another custom attribute, and then we will distribute that to all the places that that method is called from. So yeah, I think that's a really important feature.
Oh,
thanks.
I miss that a lot.
Yes, it's really needed. Yeah. Yeah.
I add another letter. Will that be propagated to the method call?
The question is, if you change the name of the parameter, or if you change the condition.
The value of the parameter. For example, this one is the username.
Yeah.
And when the contract was called, it was, let's say, AA, and I add the BB in the method.
You add BB. So if
it will
like this. Yes.
I understand. Okay, the question was if you change the value of the parameter, so if you assign a new value to the parameter in your method. No, the preconditions are checked before method entry. So we're not going, you know, if you're using the parameters as local variables within your method body and making updates to them, that happens after the precondition has already passed.
Yeah.
So yeah, then we would not check that.
So in this case, all the fields are basically read-only. So we just need the precondition. But if you change fields in the code, you probably want an invariant saying that whatever function changes a field, the following should still hold. So it's no problem. We just need to put this into an invariant instead of a precondition or both.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you put a comment or something? So valid username or something?
Nothing. So the question was, can you do something beyond just getting the condition itself. Yes, for all of the contract methods, there's overloads that also take a string. So you can say something like,
in Danish.
Oh, no, yeah. Right. So you can add a string there. Because we're, again, limited by the fact that this isn't a language solution, but is a library solution, and there is not lazy method calls in .NET, everything's evaluated strictly, we try to enforce that you put only literals there. Because if you put, you know, say some method call that's going to do an environment lookup and get a resource string and localize it, that's going to be evaluated even on passing preconditions, right? And you don't want to pay that penalty. So we try to encourage you not to do that by our tools look, and if it doesn't seem that it's something that is a literal or a static field, then the tools will warn you and say, you know, you're probably putting something in there that you might not want to do. Yeah, good question.
Okay.
So
far, we were in a nicely isolated setting. I had an interface, and we could define a stub for the interface. But sooner or later, you always have a situation where you have to do some call to the environment. In every interesting program, sooner or later, you probably want to do a network message or show a dialog, something. So for example, let's say, where's my implementation? Let's say in our code, we have to do things depending on the current time. And the following is kind of a simplified version of some logic you might have to deal with different schedules. So let's say that when there's a particular time we don't ship. So only when the, you probably all remember the year 2000 problem. So on a certain date, we don't ship. Yeah. When you write the code, it might look more complicated, but it boils down that there's an environment dependency, and depending on the current state that you don't quite control, bad things might happen. We have a testing problem now. So this isn't deterministic anymore. We cannot even trigger this in any reasonable way. I mean, you would have to actually go to the Windows settings, change the date. And if you look closely, actually, it will only not ship in the year 2000, 1st of January, at 0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds, and so on. So it's really tricky to get the time right. And when I run PEX right now and to generate test cases for this program, there's no built-in knowledge in PEX about different environment interactions. So PEX doesn't know what daytime now is doing. And so we cannot find the issue that we have, that sometimes there's a mismatch between the shipped quantities. So let's go back to the slides. We did that. Yeah, just showed that. So what we would like to do for testing purposes is to just redefine what daytime now returns. Yeah, but so this kind of illustrates what you might be able to write in a dynamic language such as JavaScript, so you can just redefine anything. But in C#, you cannot do that. You have static binding, and when you have a static method like this property, you just cannot do it. And that's where a framework comes in that is part of PEX, and you can also download separately. It's called molds. What molds do is they generate a facade for all the types, which allow you to do, for testing purposes, to redirect method calls just as we wanted, but with a bit of name mangling syntax. So as you can see, the type name gets prepended by an M letter, and the method name or the property name gets mangled a little bit too. So the idea is that for every method in existing classes, we will generate corresponding methods in a new type that has the letter M. And just as before for stubs, the idea is that for every method, there's a property you can attach a delegate to. So in this case, for datetime now, we have to attach a delegate that is a func of datetime. So a function that doesn't take any arguments and returns a datetime. When you set a property, a delegate, then under the hood, we are using code instrumentation to detour all further calls to this datetime now method to your delegate. Yeah. Okay. And what I can do now is I can make my unit test a bit more powerful to say that, well, the assertion should hold not just for any order, but in fact for any time. So I can add another parameter, the time, and I can add the invocation of our mole, setting a delegate which will return the now parameter. So this now says for any order, for any time, ship the right number of quantities. Yeah. Whatever logic we have in there about time, in the end, it shouldn't matter for the quantity. Okay, so let's do that. So I will take the code and add it to the test project. Okay, we have the code now. It doesn't quite compile yet. It complains about a missing M datetime type. So there might be many, many types around. You might have your own product code where you define your own types. And we don't have M types ahead of time. We have to tell PEX that for a particular assembly, we want M types generated. So the way you do that is that you can right-click on the test project and add a new kind of item. So I do add item. And after installing PEX or molds, you get a new kind of item here, molds and stubs for testing. I accept that. And then what you get is an XML file that allows you to configure for what types you want molds to be generated. So the datetime type lives in MS-CoreLib, that is the central library of the core.NET types. And now we can configure a bit more what we want. So before we talked about stubs, which are classes that we generate for interfaces. Now I don't want stubs in this case, so I can disable stubs for MS-CoreLib. And I want molds. And so if I wanted molds for everything in MS-CoreLib, I wouldn't have to configure much. But I just want molds now for daytime. So I do that by adding some XML tags here. I say, I don't want everything. I just want it for daytime now. Daytime. Okay. Then I save the file. And what happens now is there's a green bar at the bottom. We generate these mold types. Okay, done. So as a result, we now have a new file added to our project, mscorelib.molds, which contains the new types. So for whatever assembly you have, you can just generate mold types for it. And now in the test code, I can get things to compile by just adding another using clause. So all mold types live in a subname space called .molds. Okay, so now it should compile, and I should be able to explore this parameterized unit test. So what PEX has to do now is to figure out values for orders and values for the time. And let's see what PEX comes back with. So on certain dates, everything works nicely. And as usually, PEX starts with the simplest possible value. That is the default daytime. And then PEX discovers by looking at the code. So PEX doesn't know about special dates. It's looking at the code, and it picks up the condition and generates exactly the value at the right time and the right second where things go wrong. And then we get the assertion failure that the wrong number of items were shipped because we were missing them. Any questions? Yeah?
If the method under test calls date time now several times and I wanted to return something new each time, can I do that?
So the question was, what if the method date time now is called multiple times within a test case? Can we return different values for every time? So the answer is that you are free to write any kind of code here in the delegate that you attach. So I can have some kind of counter where I count how often a method gets invoked, and I can say, well, if it's zero, then return now. Well, let's say we first increment it, and then it's one. If it's two, then the second time, then we could return something else. Which we could compute or so on. So you can write arbitrary code. Then we need a default value. Now it should compile. Almost. Okay. So you can write arbitrary code in here, and you can have state that is maintained between different calls. So another thing you could do here is, so let's return to the original return now. I could have a Boolean flag that checks whether the method gets called at all. So if it gets called, I set it to true. And now at the end of my test, I could assert that it got called. So we don't, PEX and molds does not come with an API that allows you to express things like, the first call, this should happen. The second call, that should happen. Assert that a method got called. All of that you can easily program using delegates and lambda expressions and closures just as code in C#, or VB, or F#, any .NET language.
But it might be nice to specifically have some way of asserting an IEnumerable or something for that.
So the question was, what if there's a collection? Would be nice to have a way to easily deal with innumerable. You can write your own helper types that do whatever kind of problem you have at hand, but we do not impose or restrict you to any kinds of scenarios. Very powerful, delegate-based approach. Any other question? Yeah?
I'm just thinking, comparing this to other frameworks like TypeMock or the dynamic implementation framework, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Their models are more like record, replay, or sort of, you know, just in the code you specify, okay, I want to override, you know, this console write line or in time now.
Yeah.
Programmatically without generating, you know, M types. Is this expensive to generate, you know, for something like MS Code with types?
So, yeah. So the question is, how does this compare to other mock frameworks, for example, TypeMock? So other frameworks provide a rich API to do record replay scenarios. And also the second question was whether there's a big overhead generating these M types. So regarding the first question, so we don't impose a record replay scenario. You can basically build that on top of molds, but we don't impose it on you. What's really nice about delegates and molds is that you can factor out some common code that you might use frequently. You move it into a function and reuse it in many places. So these record replay approaches usually come with a very strict scheme how you have to write down the test, and it basically doesn't allow you to refactor test code and reuse it as much as you might like to. So this is more powerful. It also gives you more freedom, and sometimes more freedom, it comes with responsibility. So it's up to you to make the best out of it. The other question was about overhead. So it's true that initially generating the mold types does take a second or two, but you only do that once. Then the overhead is minimal. So one of the motivations behind molds was that it's extremely simple. We have these mold types. All you do is attach a delegate. In other frameworks, there's a lot of code generation going on at runtime. So they don't pre-generate stub types, but they have to generate them then at runtime. So every time you run a test case, they generate code on the fly. So running test cases in their setup takes longer, whereas in our case, you have the initial hit of generating the M types once. Okay. Then, oh, one more. So the question is, how do our tools relate to FXCop? And so, I guess we want to distinguish the static checker that is part of code contracts and PECs. Maybe you can say some words about...
Actually, could you repeat that? I'm not quite sure you got all that.
Because now you're always running PECs as a tool. You're not executing the unit test. So executing unit test is just to prove that you're executing PECs is right. That don't do anything, right? Because you're already getting the errors in the system.
Yeah. Okay, so... I think there are two questions. So one is, in general, how does this relate to FXCop?
Okay.
And then there's the other question. All I was doing here, I was running PECs, and it generated unit tests as code, but we were never actually running the generated tests. How does that fit together? So when you run PECs, it generates test cases, and it emits them as unit tests, annotated with the test method attribute. So the idea is that you can take these tests and you can just execute them by themselves. You can tell your manager that you wrote them. Yeah? No more PECs needed. So... what is going into the source control system? So you want to check in these tests into the source control system. They act as regression tests that you can quickly run. Like generating tests with PECs takes a bit longer. So running the tests later on is much quicker. And so when you make a change in the future in your code, you might first want to run the generated test to see what is the impact. Did I break any of the things that worked in the past? And then you can run PEX again on your new code. Then PEX will discover new corner cases that you just added to your code so that you get feedback on new errors you might have had, you might have made in your code. Does that make sense? Yes. PEX also so the question was, does PEX also remove tests? So yes, every time you run PEX, it maintains the generated set of tests. It removes tests that are no longer needed because maybe you removed some code. And it doesn't make sense anymore to have many tests that exercise code that no longer exists. So
PEX is more or less your source and not the tests.
PEX is your source. So you definitely want to keep and edit the PEX method. And it is true that, in some sense, it's a generator for all the individual tests. But the individual tests have value in themselves. You want to keep them for two reasons. First, they run much faster than if you would regenerate everything from scratch. So if you make a change and you first want to get some feedback whether you broke something in a far distant other part of your code, you just run your existing test suite.
I think the answer is yes. In your source control, you would keep both the PEX tests, the parameterized unit tests that you wrote by hand, and you would keep the generated unit tests that PEX has generated for you. And then by running PEX in the future, you're going to keep those synchronized.
Yeah.
The second, which is, you know, the implementation.
So the
published, I think, the same thing.
Yeah. So the question is, why have these M types if you could achieve something similar by using link or expression trees in .NET that allow you to write code and then basically reflect over it to get out a call. So I don't know how many people are familiar with other test frameworks that use this technique. So we believe that modes are better for a number of reasons. One is you get, let me show that. So you get much better support in the editor when using modes. So here, when you want to attach a mole, you type in the M type, you press a dot, and then you get all the attachment points for the different methods. So my experience with other approaches where you have to first write a complicated expression that then internally gets reflected over, it's not so clear what you have to write, what things mean, how to put things together in a correct way. And with modes, that's very easy. Basically, you cannot go wrong. Yeah. So you get here now all the help from the editor telling you what is available, and then everything is strongly typed. The only thing you can attach here is a delegate that is a function that returns a datetime. Yeah? Yeah. So let's go back and wrap up.
Yep. So I just wanted to finish up. If there's more questions afterwards, we're happy to hang around, but we don't want to hold people up that need to get back and do, you know, real important work instead of looking at us. What we tried to show you today is the kinds of things that are coming out of our research group. In particular, for code contracts, we've worked with the product group very closely. And in .NET 4.0, we're able to ship the contract library itself. So the definition of the class and the signatures all exist in MS CoreLib and can be used in .NET version 4 just directly. And then you can go to DevLabs separately and download our tools. And today you'll get the runtime checker, the static checker. I didn't have time to show the documentation generator. You saw the Visual Studio add-in. It also comes with MS Build integration, so you don't have to use it through the GUI. It's easy to use on build servers. And we showed you a little bit of a feature that we haven't shipped yet, which is these adornments that are visual elements in Visual Studio. We'd like to encourage you to, you know, try it out, go back, put contracts everywhere you can possibly use them, and let us know if it works out.
And also give PEX a try. So PEX is a Visual Studio 2010 power tool. It enables parameterized unit testing. And then PEX explores parameterized unit tests, gives you a test suite that achieves high code coverage and is usually rather small. PEX also comes with a framework called Molds that you can also get in isolation that allows you to get stubs and molds to isolate the code from the environment. So all of our tools you can get from our websites. And so we have links to documentation and downloads. We also have forums. So try it out and then give us feedback.
Because this is a really crucial point. So the product teams at the moment for .NET and Visual Studio are in the planning stages for the next version. And so they're highly, I mean, this is the right time to have community input. So if you try the tools and you like them, or if you don't like them, please, they monitor the forums. Please feel free to jump in and leave lots of comments. We'd really like to find out whether or not the things we've been doing are going to help you in your development process in making better, more reliable, more robust code.
So we have one forum for code contracts and one forum for PEX and molds, and you can see by the numbers, so there are quite a number of threads going on already. Just add some more.
Both of us work in a group in Microsoft Research in Redmond that's called the Research in Software Engineering Group. There's a lot of other projects. We just showed you a tiny piece of what things are being done in our group. We encourage you to go to our website, take a look. There's lots of videos that have small presentations about all the different research that's going on. Anything you're interested in, please feel free to get in touch with us, and we'd love to talk about it with you. Great. Thank you.
Okay.